I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of Badger, a company that produces all-natural organic body care products, including lip balms, oils, soaps, and sunscreens. The company is based in rural New Hampshire and was founded in 1995. Bill, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Long Island, New York.
What did your parents do?
My parents were both postal workers. My dad was a letter carrier. My mom was a clerk. Most of my cousins worked in the post office, and I was a letter carrier for 3 years.
And what were your ambitions? Did you think that you would also be an employee of the U.S. postal system?
I thought I wouldn't be. I thought that I would do something different.
What were some of the things that you thought you might be?
I don't know. I'd have to sort of reverse that. I was talking to my wife recently, and we were driving along, and I said, wow, I could have been a cab driver. I was a cab driver mm-hmm. on Long Island, and I thought, I could have been a cab driver, and look what's happened. It's so, you know, a strange twist of fate, and you end up something different than you thought you might have been. And I thought if I had ended up a cab driver, I'd be a cab driver that people would want to ride with.
Why is that? Why would people want to ride with you?
I'm a nice guy.
You live in Gilsum, New Hampshire.
Yes.
How did you make your way from Long Island, New York, to rural Gilsum, New Hampshire?
Interesting. I got out of the Army in 1970, and I think I was a little bit of a lost soul, and I ended up really liking to hike or just go out in the wilderness. And so I ended up hitchhiking up to the White Mountains and spending time there and then passing through Boston on the way back to Long Island. And I ended up moving to Boston and working in a restaurant. And then from there, I moved up to New Hampshire, I guess because I liked the lifestyle and the countryside. And I just like New Hampshire.
You mentioned you were in the military. What did you do in the military?
I was a combat soldier in Vietnam, mm-hmm. combat infantryman in Vietnam. And my experience was I was a Buddhist combat infantryman in Vietnam, and that I evolved in my year there to understand that there really was no difference, that the people that we were fighting were actually not the enemy. They were soccer players and artists and cooks and nurses and moms and sisters, and it was heartrending to me to think that, you know, I was in that environment.
When you were in combat, how did you see each person as an individual?
There was actually a letter was found on a body of someone that was killed, a Vietnamese that was killed, and it was translated, and one side was a grocery list, and the other side it said, I'm a woman with a husband and children, I love them, and I don't know what will become of our lives. My feeling was, I hope I don't hurt someone, and if someone hurts me, that I know it's not out of malice, it's circumstances.
And you mentioned that you were a bit of a lost soul. Did you feel like you were kind of nomadic professionally until you found Badger, or how did you feel about your profession prior to starting Badger?
Well, I eventually gravitated to being a carpenter, and I loved doing that. So I wasn't a lost soul anymore. I think I stopped being a lost soul probably when I met my wife and had kids. But before that, I was a little wanderer.
How did you meet Katie, your wife, who is very active in the business with you?
Well, a part of my migrations, when I moved to Boston, I met some people who had a farm in New Hampshire called Another Place, and they put on conferences. It was an alternative conference center. So I said, I can put on a healing arts fair. What's that? Well, a healing arts fair would be a celebration of different modes of healing, massage or chiropractic or different kinds of, you know, music therapy or things like that. So I put on the New England Healing Arts Fair for about 3 years, and Katie came to one of those weekends, and we fell in love.
Now, you are an herbalist as an avocation. How did you discover the herbal life?
See, I think destiny, or I think time works backwards. And what I mean by that is when you do a biography, you'll say, well, this person became a great ball player because when they were younger, they were given a bat when they were 7 years old, and then they went to summer camp and they practiced really hard and became this great ball player. The biographies never ask the question, well, what about the 100,000 other kids who had the same background? didn't become this great ball player. So I think that I always had an attraction for plants, even when I was a little kid. I used to love honeysuckles and those, you know, little sour sorrel. I just really liked plants. And so I think that was a part of how I was drawn to that. But when I was working in Boston at one point, I was working in a natural food store where there was a whole bank of herbs and books on herbs. So I started reading them, and somebody said they could parachute you into an abandoned lot in Boston and you could survive, because I knew all the herbs at that point in time. And I used to make herbal teas and compresses and so on. So I've always had a love for that kind of thing.
How close were your parents to this all-natural herbal life, living on Long Island and working in the Postal Service?
It was actually a contrast, because all of my neighbors were old country Italians. My dad was Irish Catholic. My mom was an Austrian Jew. So they were a funny kind of a combination, especially in those days. But we had a lawn and everybody else had gardens, beautiful gardens. And one of my early learning experiences, I was told, don't go in the Parziel's garden. And I was about 4 years old, and I crawled over into the garden one day. I wasn't supposed to, but it was really, really hot. And I got between the rows, and the soil smelled good. And I turned over on my back, and the leaves were green, and the sky, I remember, was bluer than I'd ever seen the sky before. And then I saw this big fire engine red long, what I thought was a fruit. And so I picked that, and then I think I had an out-of-body experience, because the next thing I know is at the back door yelling, "It burns, it burns," and I thought it was on fire, and I had stolen a hot pepper. And so I think I got over stealing at an early age.
Do you like hot peppers?
Love hot peppers now.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of Badger, a company that produces organic body care products. Your professional life is dedicated to carpentry. So how did Badger happen?
Well, my fingers used to split and crack in the wintertime. And one winter, it was worse than ever. It was awful, awful, awful. It was uncomfortable just to pick up a hammer. And so one night I was lying in bed with olive oil-soaked socks covered in plastic bags. I thought maybe that would help. And the plastic bags were crinkling, and Katie turned to me and she said, "That's pathetic. You can do better than that." So I started tinkering around and eventually made something that healed my fingers. And I thought, wow, I could sell this in the lumberyards. So that was the genesis of the idea for Badger, but it was about 3 years before I actually had one product, Badger Healing Balm, relief for hardworking hands, and the packaging for it and the whole thing.
What were the ingredients?
Well, the ingredients originally were olive oil and beeswax. I thought, this is great. It's so simple and it works. And the first one I made had the consistency of a hockey puck. I could have gone into a hockey puck business, but eventually I got the consistency right. And we had this gal and her son living in an apartment in our house. And the boy came down. He was probably 9 years old, I think. Garrick Teague, I think his name was. And he looked at my packaging. This was the mock-up packaging. And he turned it over and he looked at the ingredients. And he said, "You don't have enough ingredients." I said, "No, I have enough ingredients. Olive oil and beeswax, it's perfect." He goes, "You don't have enough ingredients for marketing purposes."
This is a 9-year-old.
Yeah. And I said, "You're like a kid. What do you know about marketing? What do you expect me to do, change the ingredients for marketing purposes? I would never stoop so low." And then a few weeks later, I was ready to have the tins printed up. And I looked at it. I thought, I need more ingredients. And so I started tinkering again with the formula. And I think I improved it, in part because this little kid humiliated me with lack of ingredients. But eventually we added castor oil, which is a wonderful, wonderful healing oil, aloe vera extract, which is really good for damaged, dry skin, and essential oil, sweet birch.
Most of your ingredients are botanical. They're edible. And you mentioned castor oil. I remember taking castor oil when I wanted to go into labor because I was so-called late. And it was the worst thing I've ever tasted in my life. I have a horrible memory from it. And I guess it is edible, but it doesn't necessarily taste good. So you discovered this balm for your hands and,
yes,
and your feet. And you said it wasn't until 3 years later that you decided to really make a go of this as a full-fledged company. Did you then leave your job, or talk to me about that transition?
No, I didn't decide 3 years later. I decided I wanted to do it, but I'm really, really slow, and I tend to be a perfectionist. So I kept tinkering around with the artwork and with the packaging and with the idea. But at a certain point, I actually had to do something, and that's where Katie has been vitally important, because I'm somebody who will take forever to get something done because it needs to be perfect, and nothing will ever be perfect. Whereas Katie is a personality type is field marshal general. She wants to get it started, get it done. I'm a idealist champion. I like to, you know, envision things and, you know, imagine utopias. But what happened was, there was a point where I had really beautiful packaging, and I had an option. I could get 20 or 30 generic tins, put a label top and bottom, and do a little market survey. But they wouldn't look as good as if I bought 10,000 tins, because those would be painted. Katie said, if you're going to do it right. Get the 10,000 tins, make it look right, make it work.
So it was really the tins that that tilted the scales towards actually making a go of this in a more serious way than just kind of tinkering.
Well, certainly it motivated me, because I didn't want to drive around with 10,000 tins in the back of my van for the rest of my life.
When did you start having enough income where you were able to support your family with this new company?
Well, in October of 1995, I was still doing carpentry full time, and I was making Badger. And so I would work all day, and then at night I would fill tins, and on the weekend I'd go out and sell it. And one of the things I prided myself on when I was a carpenter was I did what I said I was going to do. And I was starting to do two things poorly instead of one thing well. So I was excited about Badger, and I was not as diligent with my carpentry work. Plus, I wasn't getting a real lot of sleep. Mm-hmm. And after 3 months of doing that, in December of 95, I had to make a decision. I talked with Katie, and we came up with, let's go for it. So I quit doing carpentry. I finished up the last of my jobs, and I sort of made a business plan. It was a one-page business plan. It was essentially go like heck until you hit break-even, and don't get rid of your carpentry tools just in case. Mm-hmm. But I started doing it full-time, and within 6 months, I actually was making marginally enough money for us to survive, which I would call break-even.
Mm-hmm. And how much money was that?
I don't know, like enough to buy food and gas.
Yeah.
And pay my rent.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of the all-natural body care products company, Badger. We'll hear more from Bill coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of Badger, a company that produces all-natural, organic body care products, including lip balms, oils, soaps, and sunscreens. The company is based in rural New Hampshire and was founded in 1995. How much money did you put into this initiative initially?
Well, I was at a job. I had very little money. I had inherited $1,500, which tells you how much money my relatives had to bequeath. But and I put that into this. And then I was at a job site, actually, and the drawings of the Badger Balm stuff fell on the deck, and I picked it up. And Heidi, who I was going to build a deck for, I had built her house, she looked at it. She said, "What's that?" And as I was explaining the idea for the business, she got this twinkle in her eye, and I said, "Heidi, forget the deck. Why don't you give me $3,000 for my business?" And she said, "Okay." So I didn't build the deck. She loaned me $3,000, and I started the business. But the more I sold, the more I was out of money, which I had read, but I didn't really believe. And so I kept borrowing money from friends, and I borrowed, I think, a total of $30,000 from friends that year. And then I went to the bank, and the bank said, "Bill, you don't have a credit history." And I said, "Well, I don't have bad credit." And they said, "It's like you dropped in from outer space. You would be better with bad credit than no credit at all. We can't give you a loan because there's no credit history." And so I got a friend who was pretty wealthy to co-sign for a loan, and got the bank to agree that at the end of the year, after I had paid them back, they would take the co-signer off and let me get my own credit line. So I had borrowed $60,000 that first year, and I ended up selling $125,000 worth in one full year, which is pretty good with one tin at, you know, $4 a pop.
Now, for city folk, a badger is a burrow animal. You just gave me a look. Is that incorrect? I'm a city girl.
No, they are burrowing. I think I'm not really a country girl, although I have been for a long time. There are no badgers in New Hampshire. I was going to call it bear paw, B-E-A-R, paw, P-A-W, and I thought, well, it's for your hands, so that's kind of cool. And I was going to sell it in hardware stores, so a paw print would be perfect. And I had that, and I did a federal trademark search. But one day, actually the day before the tins were going to be printed, I already had the plates made, and I walked into the lumber yard, and Jody came out of the back and showed me a tube of Bear Paws hand cream that somebody else made. Mm. And they had common law rights to the name, so I was crushed. And I actually called this person and I said, can you give me a letter telling me I can use that name? He said, no, I'm not going to do that. I have to protect my own product. And I said, would you like to buy my artwork? It's really nice. I've done a lot of work. And he said, no, I'm not interested. So I actually put my mocked-up tin under the pillow and I slept on it. When I woke up the next morning, I thought, the universe wants a different name. And a few weeks later, the idea came to me, I should call it Badger. And I had an artist draw up a badger paw print, and I brought this new mocked-up tin, Badger Healing Balm Relief for Hardworking Hands. I brought it to work, and Rick, who I've worked with for years, I still work with Rick, he looked at it and he said, a bear paw print is round and friendly looking. A badger paw print is medieval and skeletal looking. It looks like a weapon. It's actually frightening. Nobody will buy that stuff. Uh-huh. And I said, well, what'll I do? And he said, you need to get an artist to draw a picture of a badger. And I said, I can't afford to do that. And Rick kind of like looked at me, shook his head and turned and walked away. And he looked over his shoulder and he said, well, nobody's going to buy that stuff. And so I got an artist to draw a picture of a badger, and that's how it came to be not bear paw with a paw print, but badger with the drawing of a badger on the cover.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, the founder of Badger, an all-natural body care products company located in New Hampshire. Were there other products that you looked to as, you know, kind of role models for what you wanted Badger to be?
Not really. I thought about Tabasco sauce because people would say, well, what other products are you going to have? And keep in mind, we have about 70 products now. And I said, no, I'm not going to have other products. This is going to be a one-product company. Mm. And I'm going to sell this wherever there are carpenters in northern climates all over the country. That was my idea. And it turned out that people would call and they'd say things like, it says for hardworking hands, but I used it on my baby's rash, and it works really good. Is that okay? And I'd say, oh, sure, it's all edible ingredients. And then I thought, well, actually, people like specific products for specific purposes, and using different essential oils, you can meet those needs.
What Badger product are you wearing right now?
I have on extra strength sore muscle rub for my separated right shoulder.
What is your sore shoulder from?
It's from Aikido. And the story behind that was when I stopped doing carpentry and started doing Badger, I started to gain weight and I didn't feel as healthy because I wasn't exercising as much. Basically, I was sitting and filling balms and on the phone and selling. And so I've done martial arts since I was in my 20s. And I decided to go back to Aikido. I've done kicking and punching arts like Taekwondo. Aikido is different. It's not really about striking, and it's, I guess you would call it conflict resolution, the idea of blending with the oncoming force to neutralize it, and that really helps in business. So the example would be if there's some kind of challenge to the business rather than struggling with it and bringing each other down, you find a way to harmonize with the oncoming energy. And I find that mental state invaluable in business.
What is an example of your doing that? What is a challenge that rather than trying to hit it away, you actually kind of absorbed it and embraced it?
Well, a strange thing happened. I had found an artist for the first artwork for Badger, and we agreed upon an amount that I would pay him. It was very reasonable because he knew I didn't have much money. And somewhere along the line, I sold the first 10,000 tins, and I called him up. I was really excited, and I said, hey, I sold that first 10,000 tins, or almost, and I'm about to get more. And he said, well, you can't get more. I own the artwork. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you didn't execute something called a work made for hire, which means I own the copyright on this artwork, and that if you want to use it again, you're going to have to make me a partner or pay me a large amount of money. And I said, but you knew what the intention was for the artwork. I would say that's immoral. And he said, well, you can say what you want, but that's what you're going to have to do to go forward. So I thought, well, I can't have a person like that as a partner because that's not the kind of person you want to buddy up with. I don't have a lot of money. And I thought about Aikido, and I thought, I'll just turn this a little bit. And what I did is I called him back, and I said, Chris, I can come up with $1,000 to give you. I think you've earned that, and you deserve that. And you will execute the work made for hire. And he said, no, I'm talking partnership or big bucks. And I said, if you don't do that, then I'll abandon the artwork and I'll start over again. And you have till tomorrow to make that decision. So he decided to take that rather than have nothing happen. So I had to be willing to let go of the struggle and start over again.
Just as you were willing to let go of the struggle for Bear Paw.
That's true. That would be another case of going with, you know, the universe wants something different. Let's go with it.
So here you are with your product that has, it seems, more versatility than you initially thought, with people coming to you and saying, hey, can I use this for my feet and on my baby's tush? Were there any initial turning points that really caused the business to go from, you know, just this one-off product to ultimately 70?
Well, the first big evolution was I went to large accounts. I went to Eastern Mountain Sports that had 70 stores, introduced my product to them. They did a test. They said it was very successful, and they put it in all 70 stores.
How were you able to keep up with production given the demand for it?
Well, I'm a carpenter, and I'm used to I've done jobs where I do them on my own, or I find a bunch of different people and have five carpenters if it's a larger job. So that's one of the ways I approach this. When the business started to grow, and because I wanted to sleep and I wanted to have a healthy lifestyle and have time with my kids and with my wife and my garden and so on, I hired people. Whenever I saw the need and the ability to do that, I would hire somebody.
It seems that you've had a charmed professional life since starting Badger. The demand was there. You had the capital ultimately from the bank and your friends and family. What was more challenging for you than you thought? Or what are some of the dark days that you've had with the company?
Well, there have been times when it's been financially really, really difficult and we've had to let people go. And it's especially difficult for Badger because we run the company more as a family than as a business in a way. We treat people the way we would like to be treated and with kindness and respect, and that makes the best possible business, in my opinion. But you can imagine what it would be like if you have to let someone go because you're dropping like a stone and the economy is not supporting the growth of the business.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of Badger, a company that produces organic body care products, including balms, oils, and sunscreens. In 2004, you developed a sunscreen for Badger. What was special about that sunscreen?
Well, we have a principle. Instead of thinking about a target consumer, I think that's disrespectful to talk in that way, or even doing a market survey, I think it's reasonable to make something for someone you love. So imagine if you were going to produce a product and you were making it for your baby, the kind of care and attention you would give to that product. And when you have something that you would be proud to give them, that you feel like it's safe and it's good enough and it'd be a great thing to give them, then you put that out in the world. And in the case of the sunscreen, I saw one of the women in shipping wearing a sunscreen in the wintertime. And I asked why she was doing that, and she said, well, I've had, you know, skin problems, skin lesions, and my dermatologist said I need to wear a sunscreen every day, even in the winter. And I looked at the ingredients, and I was kind of appalled, so I started reading about sunscreens, and I found that most of them have lots of chemicals, and I thought, I bet I could make a really pure one. And so I made one that basically uses botanicals, and then the active ingredient is zinc oxide. And so zinc is a mineral, and it's oxidized. It's like rusted or something, but it's a mineral that's been used for 300 years in things like diaper creams and calamine lotion. So I thought, well, that will be the safest, most effective sunscreen that you could make. The problem is it won't be the most aesthetic sunscreen in the world because zinc is whitening. And I thought, I'll never sell much of it, but people will use it on their kids and on their babies. And, you know, if they're home or in the garden, they're not worried about the aesthetics.
And shortly after you developed the product, the Environmental Working Group published a report saying that your product was the safest on the market. It was rated number one among 750 other competing sunscreens. And the Today Show on NBC picked you up. Talk to me about that.
Well, we sold our year's supply out in about 2 weeks, but that was quite a boost. We scrambled to produce enough to keep up with the demand, and I thought that would be a one-time event that wouldn't continue, but actually it's continued to the point where we're actually the fastest-growing and best-selling natural sunscreen in the natural products industry.
What percent of your revenue comes from your sunscreen?
Probably 50%.
And then in 2010, you came out with a non-nano sunscreen that had the same ingredients, but the zinc oxide particles were just that, non-nano. What is non-nano?
Nano is a measurement, just like an inch. And so nano particles are very, very small. There have been concerns about them passing the blood-brain barrier in the scale, certainly under 30 nanometers. So you don't have to freak out if you're using a zinc oxide sunscreen. Most sunscreens use zinc oxide in a larger size, maybe 100 nanometers or maybe 70. It's still wicked small. My daughter Rebecca, who's the head of product development at Badger, said, let's make a baby sunscreen and let's use the same zinc oxide that's used in diaper cream, the large particle zinc. It's like 6,000 nanometers as opposed to under 100. And she found through high shear mixing, dispersion, homogenizing, and slow paddle mixing over 12 to 24 hours. Whatever that means. What it means is you got to jump through a lot of hoops. But if you use the large particle zinc and you mix it really, really well, it's still not very whitening, but you completely obviate the concern about nanoparticles. And when we realized how good it was, we said, well, let's do it with all the sunscreens that we make.
And what is the concern? What if the particles do seep into your bloodstream? What are people concerned about?
Well, the idea is when you have zinc oxide, it's a whitening, little flakes, kind of mirror-like, and they can disperse or reflect sunlight. What happens with nanoparticles is they start exhibiting qualities that are different than the material they came from. So if you make zinc small enough, you can't even see it. And so that has been understudied. You know, their concern is it's so small, will it operate different than zinc does? The concern is that's an unknown, that you've got something that's a wicked small particle in your bloodstream that wasn't there before.
Most of the other sunblocks or sunscreens on the market are made of chemicals, whereas yours are made of botanicals. What is the concern regarding the chemical sunscreens?
Well, there are two concerns. One of the reports that EWG came out with said...
EWG being Environmental Working Group.
You need a broad spectrum sunscreen. What that means, it protects against both UVA radiation and UVB radiation. You can think of UVB, B means burns. It's the rays of the sun that will burn you. UVA, think of aging. That's a different wavelength, but they can also penetrate and potentially cause that kind of free radical production that can result in a cancer. Zinc oxide protects against the full range of UVA and UVB radiation, so it's truly broad spectrum. So that's one concern, is you could be using a sunscreen that's not broad spectrum, protecting yourself from burning, but exposing yourself to the UVA radiation.
And therefore potential free radicals in your body.
Yes. And then the second concern is that the most used sunscreen active ingredient, the chemical active ingredient, is oxybenzone. And oxybenzone has been shown to be an endocrine disruptor, so it can screw up your hormones.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bill White, founder of Badger, a company that produces organic body care products. In addition to having all natural, eco-friendly, responsible products, you run your company in a socially responsible way. And one example of that is your Babies at Work policy. Tell me more about that.
Well, one of the women, Melinda, who worked at Badger, said, could I bring, you know, after I'm done with maternity leave, can I bring my baby to work? And we said, well, let's see if that works out. You can, as long as the baby's not a screamer and it's not, bothering other people. And it worked beautifully. We have a little system. You know, you have to have a couple of backup people. So if you're on the phone or in a meeting, someone can take your baby. And it was not difficult to find backup. I often carried babies. So once we had that, then pretty much almost everybody who could get pregnant did, it seemed like. It must have been the water or something. But we've had probably about 7 babies at work for varying amounts of time, including my granddaughter, Maya. And it was such a pleasure. And people will ask, well, doesn't that make the mom less efficient? And you would know better than I would. But I think leaving your baby behind and coming back to work really puts a crimp in your efficiency. Having the baby nearby puts a crimp in your efficiency, but your stress level is much lower and you are eternally grateful. And it's good for the baby and it's good for everybody in the community and in the business.
Just as you lead an all-natural life in your martial art practice and the products that you use for your body, what is your diet like?
I try to appreciate and love whatever I eat. And I have the opportunity, because I have a garden, to eat organically grown food pretty often. Back when we were poor and struggling, we still tried to eat organic. We just ate less, or we ate less expensive things. We were vegetarian for a long period of time. Now we eat meat. But basically, I think the principles would be avoid refined flours and sugars, eat organic, eat fresh.
Do you have a vice? Is there a go-to food sometimes that might not fit into those perfect categories?
I like ice cream a lot. And I think ice cream, for normal people not like me, is not a vice at all. But with me, I could easily sit down and just pound that ice cream till I fall over.
What flavor?
I love chocolate, but I'd be willing to have vanilla with chocolate sauce on it.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Bill White, founder of Badger.
Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Reed adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio, so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs. And now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo Ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports. So physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo Ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small. So you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom. And the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student, and he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom. And all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually I had already started to sport a beard, so my breath would actually freeze on the beard, and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of 7 indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, you know, sense of what we had put down visually on the in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, you know, in the generally the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities, and that ends up being somewhere else and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, you know, procrastinate, really. And so we were 5 or 6 of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films. And this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was in the subtitles were in English. So the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film? And that way we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates, were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we would get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that, people have a lot of time on their hands too.
Because they're not working, perhaps.
Yeah, well, life is slower generally. And they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, rush off to some meeting or work. Pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Brij Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, mm-hmm. and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of an, I would say, a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that. Because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours literally outside as I saw one executive after another just walk by me, and I couldn't get any time with him. But he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel. That was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, you know. And then I got into the car with him. I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Well, thank God for laptops. Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children, 2 boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese, and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.